Today on Enduring Word with David Guzik, pastor of Calvary Chapel, Santa Barbara.
There's sort of a normal channel running at this time where God made a covenant with Abraham. And God was going to deal through the covenant descendants of Abraham. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and institute his covenant. Okay, God, you got your channel. You got your way that you're working in the world. I get it. And then totally outside of all of that, God raises up Melchizedek. And can I say, that makes me a little bit uncomfortable. I am much more comfortable if God works in your life just the way he worked in mine. But when God starts working out of what I consider to be regular channels, it can make me a little uncomfortable. But listen, I can't deny it that he sometimes does.
As Pastor David continues his teaching through the book of Hebrews, he'll be reminding us that our ways are not God's ways. God does things in his own timing and in his own way. Often God's timing frustrates us because we tend to develop our own agendas and timeframes. The Apostle James says that we shouldn't say that we're going to do something or go somewhere at a specific time or place, but to say, if God wills, we shall do this or that. Now, with today's message, here's Pastor David.
You probably know of this great person in the Old Testament known of as Abraham, truly one of the greatest men of all of history. And in our home groups, which we're in a home group season right now, we've been studying the life of Abraham. So I think that Abraham is pretty high in the consciousness of this congregation. Well, I want you to consider that this man, Abraham, had a one-time meeting with a remarkable man named Melchizedek. And Melchizedek appears in only three verses of the book of Genesis, and then one other exciting verse in the book of Psalms that we're going to take a look at next week. But these three verses in the book of Genesis, speaking of Melchizedek, actually establish him to be a person who's vitally important. You could say this, that Melchizedek is like a comet that streaks across the sky of the Old Testament. He only appears briefly, but he burns brightly in the three verses that he appears in the book of Genesis. And added on top of that, you could think of it another way. Think of Melchizedek to be like one of those characters in a good novel or in a good movie that pops up early in the story and you think, well, that's kind of insignificant. He's just another minor character in the movie. But later on it develops that he has a critical place in the development of the story. That's Melchizedek. And so we come taking a look at this man who had this remarkable meeting with Abraham. And we come to it just understanding that the writer to the Hebrews is developing a theme. It's a theme that he introduced way back in Hebrews chapter 2, where he speaks about Jesus being our high priest. Well, in discussing the idea of Jesus being our high priest, he refers to this man who was another priest of the living God, Melchizedek, mentioned in Genesis chapter 14, verses 18 through 20. So let's take a look here. Genesis chapter 14, verses 18 through 20. If you would, keep a finger in Hebrews chapter 7, because we'll be back there. But turn just briefly to Genesis chapter 14, verses 18 through 20. We're going to read these three verses that mention Melchizedek in the book of Genesis. Just to set the stage, Abraham, this great patriarch of the people of God, has just defeated a confederation of kings who kidnapped his nephew Lot. And on the way back from that remarkable battle, he meets an even more remarkable man, this man Melchizedek, that we take a look at starting at verse 18 of Genesis chapter 14, reading here. Then Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. He was the priest of God Most High. And he blessed him and said, blessed be Abram of God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth. And blessed be God Most High, who has delivered your enemies into your hand. And he gave him a tithe of all. That's it. Three quick verses. Yet it inspires more than a chapter of the book of Hebrews. So turn back to Hebrews chapter 7. Let's take a look at just the first few verses of chapter 7 to understand what we know about Melchizedek from Genesis chapter 14. Hebrews chapter 7, let me read the first three verses of the text again. He says this, for this Melchizedek, king of Salem, priest of the Most High God, who met Abraham returning from the slaughter of the kings and blessed him, to whom also Abraham gave a tenth part of all, first being translated king of righteousness, and then also king of Salem, meaning king of peace, without father, without mother, without genealogy, having neither beginning of days nor end of life, but made like the Son of God, remains a priest continually. So what do we know about this fellow, Melchizedek, from the pages of the Old Testament and from this text in Hebrews? Well, it's really pretty simple. First of all, and I don't mean to be, you know, obvious here, but we know his name. His name is Melchizedek. And Melchizedek is a name with a meaning. If you break down the ancient words, this is what the name Melchizedek means. King of righteousness. You got to admit, that's a pretty impressive name, don't you think? Could you imagine a politician in modern America having the title King of Righteousness? I can't imagine it either. But Melchizedek had the title and it fit for him. So first of all, you got to admit, that's a very impressive title. King of Righteousness. That's what he tells us in verse 1. But he also tells us something else there in verse 1, that he was the king of Salem. Now, Salem is both a place. It's an early name for the city of Jerusalem. So he was the king of Jerusalem. But Salem also has another connotation. It's associated with the ancient Hebrew word, and you can even say the modern Hebrew word, shalom. So that's why he says here in verse 1 of Hebrews chapter 7 that he's also the king of peace. Now, don't you think these are two pretty impressive titles? King of righteousness. King of peace, but it doesn't even end there. He also says in verse 1 of Hebrews chapter 7 that he is the priest of God Most High. Friends, this just kind of blows my mind. Where did Melchizedek get to know about the living God? Who told him? Where did he go to school to be a priest? Who instituted him? Who gave him the great title, King of Righteousness? Who elected him or appointed him to be king of Salem? We don't know anything about him. We don't know anything about his ancestors. We don't know anything about his descendants. He just appears as a flash on the pages of the Old Testament. And this remarkable man comes to us as someone who knew and loved and worshiped and even represented as a priest, the Most High God. And this is remarkable. Look at how he functioned as a priest in regard to Abraham. First of all, he had a sacred fellowship meal with Abraham. That's what it meant in Genesis chapter 14, verse 18, where it says that Melchizedek brought out bread and wine to Abraham. They had a sacred fellowship meal. Now look, you don't have to be a Bible genius to associate the bringing out of bread and wine with what we celebrate in our modern age as the Lord's table, as communion. This was a sacred fellowship meal. So that's the first thing he did. He served as a priest a sacred fellowship meal to Abraham. Secondly, he blessed Abraham. There he is, in sort of a priestly way, almost with hands raised up, because that would be the typical pastor back then. In this place, as a priest, he's saying, I bestow a blessing upon you, Abraham. That's the second priestly thing that he did. And the third priestly thing that he did was he received tithes from Abraham. These gifts, this giving unto the Lord. Abraham didn't take that whatever he gave and just, you know, bury it in the ground and say, God, it belongs to you. No, he gave it to Melchizedek and he received it as a priest of the Most High God. Now, I just need to pause right here and say something. That it's interesting. And might I say for myself, even uncomfortable to consider that God raised up this priest, Melchizedek, outside the normal channels. There's sort of a normal channel running at this time where God made a covenant with Abraham. And God was going to deal through the covenant descendants of Abraham. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and institute his covenant. Okay, God, you got your channel. You got your way that you're working in the world. I get it. And then totally outside of all of that, God raises up Melchizedek. And can I say, that makes me a little bit uncomfortable. I am much more comfortable if God works in your life just the way he worked in mine. But when God starts working out of what I consider to be regular channels, it can make me a little uncomfortable, but listen, I can't deny it that he sometimes does. Are you aware of a phenomenon, especially in the Muslim world today, where many people, many in the Muslim world are coming to faith in Jesus Christ because at least initiated by a dream in which they see Jesus? Now, this kind of blows my mind. And might I say, it's sort of out of the ordinary. The New Testament doesn't talk about dream evangelism very much. And I got to say, there's a sense in which it makes me a little bit uncomfortable. But yet I think in these countries that are so closed, so blocked off to the gospel, maybe God's just saying, you can't close things to me. I'll find a way around it. And listen, if they're coming to a real relationship with the true Jesus of the Bible, who am I to gainsay it? It's just a remarkable thing. Now, I admit it makes me a little nervous. But listen, if God is moving in a Melchizedek kind of way, listen, it might make us a little bit uncomfortable, but if it's a true move of God, we should be excited about it. Yet when you consider this man, that he's the king of righteousness, that he's also the king of Jerusalem, that he's also the king of peace, that he's also the priest of the Most High God, and that his priestly office was both received and respected by the great patriarch Abraham, you understand this is a significant character in the book of Genesis, even though he appears very briefly, yet there's something even more remarkable. There's something even more striking about this man. And he mentions it here in Hebrews chapter 7, verse 3. Notice what it says about him. That he is without father, without mother, having neither beginning of days nor end of life, but made like the Son of God. Friends, I don't know, if you take that description and make it as plain as possible, you're talking about God. Who else is without father, without mother, having neither beginning of days nor end of life, made like the Son of God? And this sort of brings up an interesting and sort of one of these things that Christians love to debate within the family. Who exactly was Melchizedek? Was he a remarkable picture of Jesus thousands of years before Jesus ever appeared in Bethlehem? Or was Melchizedek an actual appearance of Jesus? Because we understand this, do we not? That Jesus existed before he came as a baby in Bethlehem. He's the eternal Son of God. And there are several places in the Old Testament where it seems clear that there is a pre-incarnate appearance of God the Son. And this may very well be just one of those spots. And people love to say, well, Melchizedek was Jesus. No, Melchizedek just looked like Jesus. And I say this, if you take those words from Hebrews chapter 7, verse 3, and if you apply them as plainly as literally, I don't think you can say anything other than this was a pre-incarnate appearance of Jesus. Yet I will allow this. It is possible that the writer to the Hebrews, under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, meant those words only as it concerns the text of the book of Genesis. In other words, as far as we read in the book of Genesis, he has no father and mother. As far as we read in the book of Genesis, he has neither beginning of days nor ends of days. Perhaps that's the case. And so I, for myself, I'll go back every time I study either Genesis or Hebrews, and I'll sort of vacillate between Melchizedek was Jesus, Melchizedek was a picture of Jesus, Melchizedek was Jesus, a picture of Jesus. Today, you've caught me on the day where I say, oh, Melchizedek was Jesus. But again, I understand the arguments both way, and ultimately, I don't think it's all that significant other to say, at the very, very least, here is a man. Well, just look at those words in verse 3. Would you look at them? But made like the Son of God. Melchizedek was made like the Son of God, and it's using a very strong and suggestive ancient Greek phrasing there. It isn't really that Melchizedek represents the kind of priesthood that Jesus has. No, no, no. Jesus doesn't have Melchizedek's priesthood. Melchizedek has Jesus's kind of priesthood. I like what F.B. Meyer, the old writer, said about this. I think he had some eloquent words regarding this. Notice this quote. He says this, "It was as if the Father could not await the day of his Son's priestly entrance within the veil, but must needs anticipate the marvels of his ministry by embodying its leading features in miniature." So there we have this man, Melchizedek, representing Jesus. And it's almost as if the Father couldn't wait for the movie of Jesus' life and ministry to take place. He had to send out a trailer before the movie, and Melchizedek is one of those trailers. Actually, the Old Testament is filled with those trailers, are they not? And they all speak to us collectively of Jesus. And in this sense, notice what it says in verse 3, he remains a priest continually. There is something eternal about Melchizedek and about his priesthood, which will be developed in the message we go through next week in the second half of Hebrews chapter 7. Now let's continue on in verse 4 to break down this idea of how Abraham tithed to Melchizedek. Notice this, verse 4. Now consider how great this man was, to whom even the patriarch Abraham gave a tenth of the spoils. And indeed, those who are of the sons of Levi who receive the priesthood have a commandment to receive tithes from the people according to the law, that is, from their brethren, though they have not come from the loins of Abraham, though they have come from the loins of Abraham. But he whose genealogy is not derived from them received tithes from Abraham and blessed him who had the promises. Now, beyond all contradiction, the lesser is blessed by the better. Here, mortal men receive tithes, but there he receives them, of whom it is witness that he lives. Even Levi, who receives tithes, paid tithes through Abraham, so to speak, for he was still in the loins of his father when Melchizedek met him. Here, the writer of the Hebrews, starting at verse 4 and continuing on, is considering the fact that Abraham, who was the father of all the tribes of Israel, or the ancestor, let's say that, of all the tribes of Israel, Abraham paid tithes to Melchizedek. So in a sense, not only does this make Melchizedek greater than Abraham, but it also makes all the descendants of Abraham under Melchizedek, because they were all in Abraham, so to speak, genetically. Now, I got to point something out here and spend a little time talking about it. That Abraham's giving to Melchizedek was greater and shows us something very powerfully, and it speaks to us about this big deal that the writer to the Hebrews thinks it was, that Abraham gave a tithe. That is 10%. That's just simply what a tithe means. He took this from Abraham and he received it, and therefore it's good to just look at this subject. And so I want to talk to you about this idea of giving after Abraham's pattern here. Now, modern Christians today like to debate, and this is one of those things that's sort of an in-house debate among believers today, whether or not the New Testament requires a 10% giving among believers unto their local church or under some kind of ministry. And modern Christians love to debate that issue. And there's different opinions on both sides. Some say this: we're not under the tithe. We just give generously as God leads us to give. That's sort of one side. Then there's another side that says this: God wants us to tithe. He wants that 10% to be a measure of our giving, without perhaps restricting it to it, being a measure of our giving, and he blesses those who do so. You know, without going into an in-depth examination of the arguments on both sides, which, by the way, if you're interested in personally, I'd love to talk to you about it personally, or you can text in a question. We'll answer it in the video studio following. But let me just say this. I'm one of those who believes that 10% is a good measure of our giving. And without getting into the whole picture, think about this. 1 Corinthians chapter 16, verse 2 says this: that each one should give as he may prosper. In other words, in the context, and you can look at it later at 1 Corinthians 16, 2, that it means that you should give in proportion to how you've been blessed. That giving should have a proportional aspect to it. And here's a simple question I ask myself. If our giving is to be proportional, then what proportion? And if that proportion of 10% was common in the Old Testament and is mentioned favorably, if perhaps not commanded in the New Testament, then isn't that a good proportion? Let me just say, and I'll just speak personally on behalf of Inga Lil and myself, and if I could, the Guzik household, we have found it to be so. We have found it to be a blessed and a good thing to give 10% of our resources back to God on a regular basis. Now, something else I want you to notice here, and notice this, after the pattern of Abraham, look at what it says in verse 4. It says that he gave Melchizedek a tenth of the spoils. That speaks to the way that we should give this proportion to God. We should give this proportion to God from the top. In other words, not from the leftovers. Isn't that a common way that we do it? And please, friends, I don't want to speak a word of condemnation. I know that this whole idea of economics and finance and all this, some of it's a tremendous challenge to some of us. But I'll give you my basic heart on this. I honestly think that it's important for the church to talk about money and material things. Not in terms of give. No. In the terms of discipleship. Because is not money and material things a critical issue of discipleship in our world today? Absolutely it is. And so listen, when I speak to you about these things, I think it's important to say that whatever proportion a believer decides to give unto God, whatever proportion a husband and a wife prayerfully decide and say, we're going to dedicate this proportion unto God. And I'm saying whether they decided to be 2% or 5% or 10%, I would say this, give it to God off the top. Don't give him your leftovers, because you know how that works. If you send all the money out every month and decide what's left over, how much of it you'll give unto the Lord, how's that going to work? And does that really honor the Lord? You see, it says here in verse 4 that Abraham gave a tenth of the spoils, and spoils there literally in the ancient language is the top of the heap. It's referring to the choicest spoils of war. When Abraham tied to Melchizedek, he literally took it off of the top. Now, there's also this other issue that people like to talk about, and I think it's a legitimate issue to talk about. Let's say a person does say, yes, God, I'm going to give to you proportionally. I believe this is what your word commands. Then, where do you give that proportion? Because look, let's face it. There are many wonderful and valid charitable concerns that a person can invest their resources for God's kingdom and good in this world. There really are. In some regard, their tithe to be their charitable giving of any sort. But let me say this. The Bible does say that there should be an emphasis in our giving on the ministries that feed us spiritually. And this is most clearly seen in 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verses 7 through 14. It's where Paul says that it is appropriate to support with material things those who give unto you spiritual things. And by the way, if I could say, this is exactly seen by what Abraham did here with Melchizedek. Melchizedek gave unto Abraham spiritual things, a blessing, a sacred meal of wine and bread. Melchizedek gave unto Abraham spiritual things, and Abraham returned back with material things. In other words, when Abraham gave his tithe, he gave it first to those who understood and ministered unto him with spiritual things. Now, the way that some Christians work this out, and I'm just going to say, the way that some work this out, is they commit 10% to their local church, and they consider that their tithe. Then, whatever they might give above that, they consider to be a sacrificial offering, and they would give it to whatever charitable works or special works that God might call them to. Now, let me say, I want to be very upfront with you on this point. I don't think I see that detailed precisely enough in Scripture to make it a command. But I think as a general principle, it's something that the Holy Spirit will speak to each individual heart about. I don't think it's enough to make it a clear command, but I do think, when I say a clear command, 10% to your local church and whatever you give beyond that, wherever you please. I don't see enough to make that an absolute command, but I do see enough to say it's a correct in principle. And let me give a few final thoughts about giving before we return to this text here. You know, whenever I talk about giving, I think it's very important to establish this principle from the New Testament and even from all the Bible, is the reason for our giving. Fundamentally, the reason for our giving is not for the sake of the church. It's not fundamentally to say, well, bills got to be paid, so on and so forth. There's expenses, there's budgets to meet. Fundamentally, the reason why we give is not for the sake of the church. I'll speak for myself. I give because I need to give.
There's much more Pastor David would like to share with you, but we've run out of time for today. This has been another edition of Enduring Word, the radio ministry of David Guzik, pastor of Calvary Chapel in Santa Barbara, California. Pastor David will continue teaching verse by verse through the book of Hebrews next time. You can order today's message for free by emailing us at radio@enduringword.com. Again, that email address is radio@enduringword.com. Sometimes it's just easier to call. Our phone number is 805-730-1400. We'll be happy to help you. Again, that number to call is 805-730-1400. You can learn more about Enduring Word and Pastor David at our website, enduringword.com. All of Pastor David's messages through the Bible are available to listen to or download for free at enduringword.com. Again, that's enduringword.com. Simply click on the radio option in the main menu. Of course, for many of us, Enduring Word commentaries have been a part of our discipleship. We'd like to encourage you to consider supporting Enduring Word by partnering with us with a one-time gift or a monthly donation. Your support helps this program extend its reach worldwide. Well, that's all the time we have for today. From all of the production team here at Enduring Word, we want to say thank you for tuning in. Next time, Pastor David will continue teaching through the book of Hebrews. That's next time on Enduring Word.